It's Halloween 1983, and I'm staggered to realize that a quarter of a century has passed since that wretched last attempt to sedate my desperation. In a way, it seems like I've been sober all my life, but in another way, these 25 years have flashed by like lightning. I can still picture the smile on the face of Sully at the 6300 Club on the night of my first birthday. The beginning of hope that I might actually stay sober. And it impresses me greatly that I've had the great good fortune to live in the only period in history when people such as you and I might have a reasonable chance for comfortable lives. I've been around this program, drunk and sober, almost three-quarters of its existence. At no other time would there have been a place to go. It sends a shiver down my spine. And as we all know, it's based on one thing, a growing awareness and understanding of the 12 steps and our only two human attempts to practice them. Even though I've heard them read probably thousands of times, I still enjoy hearing them. And it's especially touching to me to hear them read by the man who wrote them.
One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Ten, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
I first began diddling around AA about the time that the co-founder, Dr. Bob, was dying. I remember talking to people who had just attended the first international convention in Cleveland and actually heard him say his famous goodbye. He had cancer. He was to die in just 3 or 4 months and had to be helped to the stage. But the words he said then are as absolutely applicable today as they were in 1950.
My good friends in AA and of AA, I feel I would be very remiss if I didn't take this opportunity to welcome you here to Cleveland, not only to this meeting, but those that have already transpired. I hope very much that they have the presence of so many people, and the words that you have heard will prove an inspiration to you, not only to you, but may you be able to impart that inspiration to the boys and girls back home who are not fortunate enough to be able to come. In other words, we hope that your visit here has been both enjoyable and profitable. I get a big thrill looking over a vast sea of faces like this with the feeling that possibly some small thing that I did a number of years ago played a infinite, small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill, and I think that we all have the same problem. We all did the same thing. We all got the same result in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I've been in bed 5 of the last 7 months. My strength hasn't returned as I'd like, so my remarks will of necessity be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is. So let's bear those 2 things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member of the tongue. And if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing. None of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts in our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to that help that has been so beneficial to us to our less fortunate brother. Thank you very much.
I was also fortunate enough to have met and talked to Bill Wilson on a couple of occasions, to visit him in his office at the GSO in New York, and to be present at the meeting where he gave his last talk. He also was dying and had been forced to cancel out his Friday night talk at the International Convention, which was held in 1970 at Miami Beach. On Sunday morning, however, we were thrilled to learn that he would make a brief, unexpected appearance. He was brought out in a wheelchair with oxygen tubes sticking out of his nose. They pushed him with a mic to absolutely thunderous applause that seemed to go on for about 10 minutes. Then he talked. As you listen, you can hear the strength in his voice for a while. Then suddenly he weakens and stops. It was a golden memory in my life.
Dear folks, there's always something new in one's AA life. And what do you think it is with me this morning? It is that I am absolutely speechless. That is almost absolutely speechless. As I look out across this crowd, there floats back to me a mighty assurance. And this is a mighty assurance for AA's future. That indeed, it will go on for so long as God wants us. The other thing I would like to set on the record is my tremendous gratitude at being able to be with you in this finest hour of our closing me. So I can only say, may God bless and keep you and Alcoholics Anonymous forever.
Sometimes, when it seems you've lost everything, there doesn't appear to be much reason to keep going. I'm glad Bill Blake resurrected an old tape of my first talk at the Arlington meeting just after my first birthday in 1959. I guess I must have turned the corner and was beginning to realize that I could stay sober of and by myself through God and AA. One sort of amusing thing about this talk, I discovered, is that I sounded better without front teeth than I do today with them.
So AA, to me, has given me one other thing that I thought I'd lost. I guess the last time I cried was about when I was 9 years old. My dad beat the hell out of me for something, and I cried grievously. I thought, nobody will ever make me cry. And I didn't. I had tears in my eyes sometimes, but I didn't cry because, by God, nobody would ever see that I was soft again. I would keep that front arm so tight they'd never see me soft. This last Christmas Eve, I was feeling a little sorry for myself. I was about 7 o'clock at night, and everyone else was going home and wrapping presents and living it up, and I was sweeping out the store down there. The janitor was finishing up, and I thought, gracious, this is kind of a futile... What's the sense of keeping sober? Everybody else has got something. I got this broom for my Christmas Eve present. I don't like it. And the phone rang, and my four daughters called me up, and they were on the telephone from Dallas. And each of them spoke to me in turn. They said, Daddy, we're just going to bed now, and we called you to tell you that we love you very much, and we're glad that you're getting better. And we have to go now. And we talked a minute more, and they hung up. And as I say, I probably won't see them for a long time, but I went into the washroom there, and I didn't let anybody know about it, but I locked the door, and I sat down, and I cried and cried and cried. And I think that was the nicest Christmas Eve I've ever spent in my life. I felt much closer to my children than I did last year when I was in the room with them, because last year I was drunk. And each year before that, there's always some next Christmas going to be better. But this Christmas I was closer, although separated by thousands of miles. I thought, if AA gives me nothing else, this has given me something, that my daughters like me and call me, and that they're also have inherited something from me. They called collect.
As I mentioned previously, one of the most beautiful memories of my life is that 1970 convention. In addition to that, I was the speaker at noon on July 4th, in the middle of the whole thing. By an odd coincidence, the first speaker that morning was the man who brought me to AA in Eau Claire, and the last speaker that night was Chuck C. Someone played this tape for me recently and recreated what a truly spiritual experience it was for me to have a dramatic reinforcement of the feeling that I belonged all the way.
In the past 2 years, spoke at a lot of conventions in AA. I'm closing this sentence, sir. I have one sentence left. I may have some commas in it. In the last few years, I've spoken at a lot of conventions, and I've been in Washington, one of the finest AA conventions in the world, and many other conventions. So this is really a big ego trip to go speak at an AA convention. It isn't a big ego trip to be in front of people. I do that a lot in my job and everywhere else. I'll tell you the greatest thing that's ever happened to me in my life is me standing at this podium today, however. That is the best thing that has ever happened to me, because it's as though somewhere in some abstraction, Alcoholics Anonymous, which has become my life, has reached down and said, even a nut like you belongs here. We're glad to have you. Thank you.
One of the most truly fortunate things in my sobriety, however, has been the chance to be close to Chuck C., the most charismatic man I have ever known and the best example of AA in action I've ever seen. For many years after he became my sponsor, he certainly wasn't sure of me, but I was always sure of him. He's done more for all of us than anyone, perhaps since the founders. He is known throughout the world as a speaker, but is better known to me as a man whose approach to AA gives me a goal. Certainly not one that I will ever reach, but one toward which I pray I will continue to strive.
I'm saying that insofar as my experience goes to date, I believe that the only roadblock between me and you, and me and my very own God, is the human ego. I want, I don't want, I like, I don't like, I yay, 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 yay. The only roadblock there is. And that's the great significance of this thing called surrender in our program. Because it's got to go. Because it's divinely impossible to satisfy the human ego. Because it's duality. It's me against you, me against life, me against God. So, it's got to go. And when that's gone, life becomes so simple and easy and beautiful that we end up doing nothing but thanking God and passing the ammunition. And the finest formula that I've ever heard about, read about, or seen for bringing that about is our program of Alcoholics Anonymous.
That tiny fragment, or a thousand full-length tapes, could never really capture his flavor. But I'm grateful that he was here to share himself during my time in AA. I also want to thank some dear friends of mine, all now dead, but who have a special place in my heart. God bless you, Fred Fashing, Homer Borum, Ray Lundberg, Sonny Jerome, Lyle Wicks, Gus Sargent, Pat Ward, Les Ross, Jim Halloran, Dr. John Ashby, Tom Jones, John Sullivan, Bob Bailey, Jim Mason, Eddie Regan, Jack Bailey. Some of you died drunk. A couple committed suicide. But most of you went out as great AA examples. I hope you all sleep well, because you were kind to me when I could not be kind to myself. I would be indeed remiss also if I didn't offer a special thanks to my family. To Charlotte, whose resilience and tolerance for the past 34 years should certainly qualify her for a seat in God's lap. And to five of the rottenest kids that ever filled their dad with love and pride. A couple of weeks ago, I was speaking in Kansas. I had been thinking that week about what I wanted to put on this record. I made a special little message at the end of my talk that would apply then for the listeners, but which was really aimed at you. I think you are special, and there is nothing more indicative of my feelings than this.
I'm rather moved this evening. I was thinking this afternoon. My sponsor is very ill, a man who I've felt very, very close to for many, many years. My father is very ill, and my mother's very ill. I'm going there tomorrow night to see them in the hospital. All of the strengths of my early life are gone, and I am glad that people like you have made me able to stand up and realize that it's now my turn to hold up the roof for somebody else for a while, until they can get strong enough and I drop and they can hold up the roof for someone else for a while. I thank you more than for my life, because I had my life a long time without you. I thank you for giving me an ability to walk in peace most of the time, because that's infinitely beyond my fondest dreams most of my life. I am most grateful to you. Thank you. God bless you. Good night.
a characteristic feeling by every newcomer I've known, including myself, is the old suspicious thought, was it really as tough for them as for me? Or are they just trying to psych me up? For my own edification as to how it was, I contacted a few people who remember me from the bad old days and had them send me a short semblance of their recollections. When I heard them, they depressed me. But perhaps you'll get a different feeling.
I'm from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, the same place that Clancy is from. And I'm probably one of the few, if not the only one, that remembers when Clancy came into AA. And the experience I had with Clancy in and out of AA, I always thought that he was a mental case, that he was not an alcoholic. He kept going to AA in and out and getting drunk and playing cribbage, beating guys out of drinks. I remember one fellow who was an attorney by the name of Mike Bundy. He told me, he says, "I'm a sucker. That son of a bitch beats me every cribbage game, and I know he's cheating. And still I play with him." And that kept it going, and but he kept it coming back. But he never did make it, and I didn't think he ever would. We never paid much attention to him because that was just a hopeless case. Finally, Clancy disappeared. I am sure that Clancy didn't think he would make it either. So it wasn't only, so we all agreed on one thing, including Clancy, that Clancy was one of the drunks that's not going to make it.
A few alcoholics in my life. But I think Clancy was the biggest son of a bitch that I ever had. God, he was the oddest. Man, I remember one night cops called up, police, called from the hospital about 3 o'clock in the morning. They wanted me to come up there. They had a wild man up there. It was Clancy, of course. They couldn't plow him under. They had him in a straitjacket, but they couldn't plow him under. He wanted to see me. I guess the reason I knew it, I don't know, somebody saw him when they were taking him in at the old police station downtown, State Street. But I went up there, I talked to him, he told Tom, he says he's all he wanted. He wasn't going to do anything, he was just going to want a place to sleep. And I really believed him. I think probably that's what he had in mind when he went up there. I talked to him a few minutes and he rolled over and went to sleep like a little baby. I never see anything like that. It was just, I don't know. It's quite a while ago, and it kind of sticks in my crop, but why he that soothed him, like he'd confessed to me that he wasn't going to do any harm. He didn't mean any harm. And then he just rolled up, just like, kind of reminded me of a little baby. You tell them a story and they go to sleep. Well, they dropped the charges. Well, incidentally, his wife was on the third floor having a baby. That's one of his daughters. I suppose one of the kids were being born here. He was down on the second floor while she was up on the third floor. Kind of a nice present for the old girl. So his mind was thinking all right, but I don't quite understand what happened. He just couldn't seem to grasp it. He was kind of cunning. Just like he had two minds. One of them wanted to do something, one of them wanted to do the opposite. I guess that was his big trouble all the way. He had that conflict there. He couldn't figure out still be a nice guy. Well, he just couldn't because he was an alcoholic.
In the 1950s, I had a wife, 4 kids, a nice home, and a booming bar business. Very, very late, on a cold Christmas night, my good wife and I were nestled in our beds. The plate glass front door closed and locked. We awoke to the sound of shattering glass, jumped out of bed, turned on the lights, and there in the living room, clothing lightly dusted with shards of glass, stood Clancy, with an arm full of books. He said, and I quote, "I find it necessary to leave town suddenly, and wondered if you folks would be so kind as to return these books to the library before they become overdue. Why do you both look so cross? It is Christmas, you know."
I was trying to remember just more about you and some of your misfortunes back in the 50s, and I couldn't think of many, so I called an old friend, and he didn't hesitate a minute. He told me right off the bat about seeing you at the bullring in Juarez one afternoon, and you'd been up all night, and you'd been in a fright, and you were dirty and unshaven, and one of your lenses and your glasses was broken, and you needed some money. Well, he gave you a dollar, and that was the last he saw of you. And my friend reminded me that you had a habit of putting ads in the paper for some of your acquaintances. For example, you would give a fellow's telephone number at his home and run it in an ad, and the ad would say, "Wanted, boy to peddle eggs," or some such thing as, "Wanted, girl after 5 p.m. or maid with dog, seek new position." Do you recall that you always stood up for the underdog when you were drinking? And he recalls one particular incident at Five Points at a bar when a policeman was giving some fellow a bad time, and a great, big, huge policeman with a nasty disposition, and that you came in and defended the poor chap who was being abused, and you ended up taking a terrible beating. He visited you one day in the Victor B. Gilbert Mental Annex at Thomas and General Hospital, where you were in the mental ward, and you told him that everyone in there was crazy except you. It was shortly thereafter that you made your journey to Big Springs.
It was also in El Paso that Clancy very nearly finished himself in, and he got sent to the state hospital in there. Now, when he got out of that hospital, they gave me such great power. And what a mistake those doctors made to give a potential Al-Anon the power they gave me over another human being. A potential Al-Anon who could control any situation, who could take care of herself. When he left that hospital, they gave me a big stack of papers and a big bottle of Thorazine. And the Thorazine was supposed to be given to him 3 times a day. I did it faithfully. And he just sat there like a zombie. And the big stack of papers was so I could send in a weekly report on his behavior. These doctors that I respected. And I had all that power over this other human being. And at the time, I didn't realize what a really horrible thing it was. And it must have been really horrible for Clancy, too. I never openly bragged about my power and said, "Oh, boy, I've got it over him." But inside, I knew I had it. But I was very faithful. I'd give him his Thorazine, and I'd send off my little report every week just as faithful as I could be. And Clancy didn't act funny then. They told me to call them immediately if he started acting funny. And he didn't act funny again until he had his first drink of liquor again.
Clancy was a disreputable-looking specimen. Sometimes more than others. If he didn't have money to pick up his laundry, he was dirty. And I seem to remember that his front teeth were broken and missing, and he usually was in need of a barber. I asked Clancy if he wanted to work for me as a handyman. I had no idea a fellow could be so unhandy. There was very little he knew about how to do anything in a fixing or cleaning line. I gave him a large can of cold base cement one day and told him to cement the the base onto the wall. And he, instead of putting a little layer on the coal base, he smeared it, great gobs of it on the wall. It looked like fecal matter. He had a hell of a time cleaning it up. I used to see him in the back room sitting quietly in such a black mood he wouldn't even respond to conversation. Clancy tells the story that I fired him. That's not exactly my recollection. The way I remember it was I kept Clancy working because it made me feel superior. But I finally got aggravated and frustrated with him and decided to fire him. But for some reason or other, he sensed that I was going to do that, and he never showed up. I didn't see him again in my store for, well, many, many weeks.
I was manager of the 6300 Club, helping Sully run the club. And we had some wonderful characters and wonderful people coming in and going out of that club. And especially one I recall, my friend Clancy. He had set up housekeeping in the back of a car behind a signboard in back of the club, and he was managing his life the best way that he could. And that was really something. We never knew which way the wind was blowing, only what was going on in the back of the car, or when my friend Clancy was mobile enough so that we could let him in the club. And he was a brain. He really was. There wasn't an argument that he couldn't really take over.
I don't know about you people, but so far as I am concerned, this evening could never be. No chance for this evening ever to exist. Because I knew our birthday man 24 years ago. And if there's ever one man that ever came to this society that didn't have a chance, he's the man. He didn't have any chance of getting sober, let alone the other things that have happened to him. I wouldn't have given him 5 cents for the whole man and everything that he ever was and ever will be. I wouldn't give you 5 cents for it.
Well, thanks for those kind words, Paul and Fred and Jack and Bob and Charlotte and Frank and Chuck. Fortunately, perhaps, there was no one left to contact in Dallas or the Big Spring State Hospital or San Francisco or Milwaukee or a few other towns. But at least we got the general idea. I'm certainly glad I'm here. And I'm glad you're here. And I hope we'll never have to go away again.